The Ocean Liner Presidency. Democrats lost control of the House of Representatives in 2011 and of the Senate in 2015. Although Obama was resoundingly reelected in 2012, he did little on equality issues once the Tea Party tidal wave hit the Washington beach. By then, he had already veered off in pursuit of a grand bargain, in which Democrats would offer up their once sacred social insurance programs to the budgetary knife if Republicans would consider tax increases. To co-chair the commission charged with hammering out the budget agreement, Obama even chose Erskine Bowles, the man who had been Clinton's emissary to Newt Gingrich in the secret negotiations over privatizing Social Security. The Bowles-Simpson commission failed in its unsavory budget-balancing mission. So did all the other similar efforts of those years. No one outside Washington could really follow the two sides' complicated budget battles, though they dragged on for year after year. But Obama's determination to win some great Clintonian victory over the federal deficit grew so strong that for a while it canceled out nearly everything else that had once animated his hopeful supporters. Obama still had his remarkable skill with words, but at some point the eloquent president reportedly lost his faith in persuasion. His presidency had its great moments, of course, the Osama bin Laden raid, the diplomatic recognition of Cuba, the deal with Iran. But on inequality, he was reduced to making speeches. To the dismal record of the later Obama years, leading liberal class thinkers have responded in an entirely characteristic manner, by constructing a theory of American politics in which inactivity was the best anyone could hope for. Obama hasn't really disappointed at all. On the contrary, they've claimed, the powerlessness of the presidency has been one of the great determining facts of American history, a truth established by political science itself, and Obama has grappled with it as best he could. Presidents, wrote New York Times columnist Frank Brunei in 2015, are not always mighty frigates parting the waters. Sometimes they're buoys on the tides of history, rising and falling with the swells. The true problem, liberal thinkers concluded, were the whining, unrealistic idealists who expected so much from Obama, and, of course, those diabolical Republicans in Congress, constantly outmaneuvering the poor, powerless man in the Oval Office. By June 2015, Obama himself had taken to saying the same thing, relating to the comedian Marc Maron how he often had to tell his disappointed supporters that you can't get cynical or frustrated because you didn't get all the way there immediately. A little later, he offered the classic metaphor for U.S. government inflexibility. Sometimes the task of government is to make incremental improvements, or try to steer the ocean liner 2 degrees north or south so that 10 years from now, suddenly we're in a very different place than we were. But at the time, at the moment, people may feel like we need a 50-degree turn. We don't need a 2-degree turn, and you can't turn 50 degrees. And it's not just because of corporate lobbyists. It's not just because of big money. It's because societies don't turn 50 degrees. Democracies certainly don't turn 50 degrees. It is easy to understand why pundits want to write apologetics for the president, and it is even easier to understand why Obama wants to describe his own presidency in such a way. Having put so much faith in his transformative potential, his followers need to come to terms with how non-transformative he has been. Ocean liners were meant to fly. If our goal is to rescue the reputation of a hero who turned out to have clay feet, this is surely the way to go. Ocean liners are hard to turn. Presidents don't have a lot of power. Republicans are in league with the devil. If what we are concerned with is inequality, however, it would behoove us to admit the obvious forthrightly, that Obama could have done many things differently, that the Republicans aren't superhuman, and that the presidency is, in fact, a powerful office. It's so powerful that, even in Obama's worst period, with Congress entirely in the hands of intransigent Republicans, it would still have been possible for the president to use the executive branch to do big and consequential things about inequality. To name just one, he might have resumed Franklin Roosevelt's legacy on antitrust enforcement. Allow me to explain. Not too long ago, monopolies and oligopolies were illegal in America. This is because our ancestors understood that concentrated economic power was incompatible with democracy and equality in all sorts of ways. Since the days of Ronald Reagan, however, every administration has chosen to drop the enforcement of the antitrust laws, except in rare cases. This has come to mean that mergers and takeovers are permitted in nearly all instances, and achieving monopoly has once again become the obvious objective of every would-be business leader. From Big Pharma to Silicon Valley, everyone in the C-suites knows that this is the path to success today. Competition is for losers, they say. Unless your startup has a plan for cornering and using market power, you can forget about interest from venture capital. Tolerating such practices has had obvious consequences both in our everyday economic lives, where citizens face unchallengeable economic power everywhere from beer to bookselling, and in terms of the gradual plutocratization of society. Unrestrained corporate power has naturally yielded unrestrained wealth for corporate leaders and their Wall Street backers. Barack Obama could have changed this, and by extension, changed the political climate of the country, merely by deciding to enforce the nation's laws in the same way that administrations before Reagan did. The antitrust laws themselves were written a century ago and are still on the books. The current Republican Congress would have had little say in the matter. It would have been almost entirely up to the executive branch. On this front, and many others, Obama was completely free to act, especially before 2010 and even after the Republicans took Congress. The Times certainly called for it, with Amazon, Google, and AB InBev romping the globe. Still, he did next to nothing. In fact, anti-monopoly investigations conducted by Obama's Justice Department went from a barely breathing 4 in 2009 to a flat 0 in 2014. By way of contrast, in 1980, under a different Democratic administration, there were 65 such investigations. Let us return again to the financial crisis and the Wall Street bailouts, the episode that will define our politics for generations. They captured everything that is going wrong with the country, that ensured Obama's election as president in the first place. To say that Obama fumbled this most critical issue is to understate the matter pretty dramatically. More to the point is the great question of why he fumbled it so dramatically. Was it because the ocean liner couldn't be turned? On the contrary, it was fully within Obama's power to react to the financial crisis in a more aggressive and appropriate way. Laws were in place. There was ample precedent. He wasn't forced to pick the men whom Democrat Senator Byron Dorgan plaintively called the wrong people for his economic team. It wasn't the Republicans who made Obama choose Tim Geithner to run the bailouts, or Attorney General Eric Holder to not prosecute dishonest bankers, or Ben Bernanke to serve another term at the Fed. It would have been good policy had Obama reacted to the financial crisis in a more aggressive and appropriate way, by which I mean the economy would have recovered more quickly and the danger of a future crisis brought on by financial fraud or concentrated economic power would have been reduced. And lastly, it would have been massively popular had Obama swung the wheel of the ocean liner and reacted to the financial crisis in a more aggressive and appropriate way. Everyone admits this, at least tacitly, even the architects of Obama's bailout policies, who like to think of themselves as having resisted the public's mindless baying for banker blood. Acting aggressively might also have countered the sham populism of the Tea Party movement and prevented the Republican reconquista of Congress. There were countless opportunities for the kind of decisive action I am describing. Obama could have questioned or even unwound Bush's bailouts. He could have fired the bad regulators who let it all happen. He could have stopped the AIG bonuses instead of having his team go on TV to defend them. He could have pushed to allow bankruptcy judges to modify mortgages. He could have put the zombie banks into receivership. He could have shifted FBI agents back to white-collar crime and so on. Obama did none of it. This is a critical point. On the matter of dealing with Wall Street, there was no conflict between idealism and pragmatism. The high-minded and Jeffersonian move, in this case, would have also been the practical move, the policy that would have been healthiest for the nation, the one that would have paid off best in the crude terms of public opinion polls. And still he didn't do it. He didn't even try. In fact, Obama's team did the opposite. They did everything they could to foam the runways and never showed any real interest in confronting the big banks. Obama didn't play the greatest of all issues the way he did because getting tough with Wall Street would have looked bad, or because the presidency lacks sufficient power. Everything I just mentioned was eminently doable in 2009. Putting banks into receivership is a common and even sometimes necessary legal procedure. The country was begging Obama to do it, but he chose not to. Once we acknowledge this, we must acknowledge the possibility that Obama and his team didn't act forcefully to press an equality-minded economic agenda in those days and in the years that followed because they didn't want to. That he and they didn't do many of the things their supporters wanted them to do because they didn't believe in doing those things. It wasn't because the ocean liner would have been too hard to turn or because those silly idealists were unrealistic. It was because they didn't want to do those things.